Why is Mathnasium one of the world's fastest growing franchises? Because demand for after-school math help is skyrocketing, making it an exceptional financial opportunity with the power to change lives. That's also why Mathnasium is consistently recognized as the number one math-only education franchise. With over 1,100 centers worldwide, Mathnasium is the trusted brand in math education, helping students build confidence and develop a love for math. Protected territories are available. Get your free franchise information kit at mathnasiumfranchise.com. That's mathnasiumfranchise.com.
Adobe Express makes it quick and easy to create everything I need for my business. From social posts, TikToks, and flyers, all in just a few clicks. Get Adobe Express for free. Search for Adobe Express to find out more.
Hey, it's Dan Bova here at Entrepreneur. Thanks for joining us here on How Success Happens, the show where I get to talk with people who are smarter, more talented, and more successful than I am, which is just about everybody. But today's guest is really good. This guy's an actor who's appeared in so many fantastic shows and movies. We could be here for an hour listing them all. Red Notice, Silicon Valley, the voice of Mickey Mouse, to name a few. But you can see him in the brand new comedy heist show, The Sticky, on Amazon Prime right now. So please welcome a guy with one of the most fun names to say in human history, Chris Diamantopoulos. Chris, did I get it?
I mean, you should pack up now and move to Greece, because they would welcome you with open arms. I'm just saying. Listen, you better get ready. People are going to be sending you feta and olive oil. You did it. You might get a sheep in the mail. I'm just saying.
All right. Well, thanks you all for listening. I'm heading to Athens. No, thank you. Thank you. And man, I know how to say your name. And I was like, I'm getting in my head so much about this. And
it's a lot. It's so many letters. It's, you know, it is the Smith of Greece, though. You know, if you walk down a street in Athens and say Diamantopoulos, you'll have about 750 people. What's your problem?
Awesome. Yeah. So, Chris, busy man. We've got The Sticky, which is out now as we speak.
Yep.
You have a new show called Criminal in the Works. We saw you in Boys in the Boat, Red Notice. So I'm trying to think where to start, and maybe that's a good question for you. I mean, you've had your career such great longevity. Everything you've been in has been awesome. Like, how do you determine what Chris Diamantopoulos is going to do next?
That's a great question, man. Look, I've got four kids, so much of what Chris Diamantopoulos does next is predicated by, let's make sure we take care of the fam. So, look, I think I listen to a lot of actors talk about how mindful they are in role selection. And, you know, you started this out by saying that you talk to people that are, you know, smarter and more talented. You definitely didn't get the right guy on the show for that one. what I will say is that I'm pretty lucky that I've been able to turn into a vocation, something that has been a passion of mine since I was 3 years old. I've recognized what performance means to me from such a young age. I recognized how I felt inside, and how I still feel when I see a movie that moves me, or something on stage that moves me, or a television show. That feeling that I've been able to monetize that and turn that into a vocation, which also happens to be, sadly enough, my hobby as well. You know, I envy these people that love riding motorcycles or going fly fishing or whatever it is. The thing that I love doing is what I do. I love acting. I love it. It annihilates me. It destroys me. It pains me. It brings me to my knees. But I absolutely love it. So my selection process is really, look, I look first and foremost for, can I add value to the project? You know, however good it is, however great the filmmakers are, or how brilliantly written it is, can I add something to this? Or is this going to be something that takes from me something that I don't necessarily want to give, right? That's the first thing. Then it's, you know, I'd love to work with Steven Spielberg, right? But what are the odds that the number one in his movie is going to be looking for me? You know, there are probably other criteria that go into it. So the next question is, you know, how likely is it that throwing my hat in the ring will actually bring me to this, right? You know, but you look at a movie like Boys in the Boat that was directed by George Clooney. I knew that I would have a chance in an ensemble piece if I could try and find a role that I could add value to, but that was a realistic get for me at this stage in my career. And I've been doing this a very, very long time, but I still look at myself as I'm still in the beginnings of my career. You know, I've been doing it for 40 years, effectively as an adult for 20 years, but I'm still just getting going. And that's both an exhausting thought, but it's also a liberating. It's a liberating thought, because that means that, again, with four kids at home, I'm never going to stop working, man. I'm going to work for the rest of my life because it gives me so much joy. So, you know, those are the things that I try to marry together. And then, and ideally, it's something that I didn't just do. It's something maybe a little different. If I did a comedy, maybe something a little dramatic. If I did something straight-laced, maybe a little more madcap. And that's where animation can really come in to offset some of the stuff that I do on screen.
Do you remember your first paying gig?
Yes, I do. The first, you know, it's funny, I've only ever done this for a living. I was 9 years old. My first paying gig was a Honda commercial in Toronto, Canada. I was in a Honda commercial. It took 5 days to film this thing. They were doing a sort of stop motion thing with the car where they were like showing it moving in segments. And I was in the back seat and there were actors playing husband and wife in the front seat. I was playing with toys in the back seat and they were like, you know, debuting this new car. But I remember even at nine, the guy playing my father and the woman playing my wife, they were kind of into each other and they were flirting in the car. And I remember, you know, listening to this thinking, do you need a minute? I want to get a room, but there was all this fog, you know, that they put around the car. And so that we were in that car for a while. And I remember the guy under his breath going, if this kid wasn't in the room, you know what I mean? But I blocked that guy from having a really great shoot.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
He could have had the happiest Honda day of them all, but you were.
But that was my first paying gig. And that was a pretty good payday, actually. That guy, you know, it got me in the Actors Union in Canada, and I did a slew of national commercials. It really got me going.
That's so great. So the Sticky, this is, for people who don't know, this is about a real heist that involved the theft of $18 million Canadian of Quebec's maple syrup.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, too, though, so you've got Criminal coming out.
Yes, sir.
Which is based on an amazing graphic novel by Ed Brubaker, interlocking series of crime stories. Chris, crime seems to be something that speaks to you.
Well,
anything you want to confess here?
You know, it. What's that line? What's the play and what's my part? Right. I am an actor. I'm a journeyman. I've been doing this forever. You know, and there are certain things that are in vogue and then they go out of vogue, right? You know, in the 80s and the 90s, a guy that looked like me at my age was probably going to be the lead guy, right? Probably the good guy. That's not the case anymore. That's for better. You know, there's an inclusivity and an opening up of the doors that's allowing for a bigger and more robust and diverse look at what a good guy and a bad guy look like, right? I guess I'm what a bad guy looks like. I'll take it. You know, I to be perfectly frank, when I used to watch Errol Flynn in Robin Hood, I loved Basil Rathbone. Okay. You know, Basil Rathbone was the one that I just thought, whoa, man, that guy. And then I saw him again in The Court Jester with Danny Kaye. He had a ball. So, you know, I really do. I think there's something fun, and there's definitely a lot more scenery chewing allowances for the bad.
Yeah.
So, I'm a performer. I like going big.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about this, the true story of this, but also your interpretation of this character. Because I read one quote from you. You said I guess he starts off with one plan, but then his character starts oozing out of his pores like maple syrup through a degraded waffle.
That's pretty. That's actually a pretty good description. Did I say that? That
you did. You were quoted as saying that.
Well, look, here's the deal. So the original story, you know, from what I know, and I'm not an historian, but in 2011, first of all, a lot of people don't know this. There is an association, a federation of a global maple syrup reserve. It's in northern Canada. And they pool together with the maple syrup farms, and they hold a reserve in these giant football stadium-sized warehouses, these oil drums, thousands and thousands and thousands of oil drums of maple syrup, and they decide who to dole it out to. They, you know, they look at a big map and they're like, Australia's low, send them 450,000, you know, Germany's running low. You know, it sounds like a plot from like a Mickey Mouse cartoon. You could almost imagine, we're low on maple syrup in Austria, send it right away. You know what I mean? It's like, so, but it's true. This is what they do. They hold the syrup. And now the idea is that a lot of the maple farmers are a little disgruntled about this. And they feel like the association doesn't have their best interests at heart. Like, why should one association or federation decide how much they can produce and how much they can sell? When the farm is producing a ton this year, they should be able to sell it all and really make that money. So, you know, it's this egalitarian sort of idea of, hang on a second, is this helping us or is this, you know, the federation says, no, we're helping because we've got it all under one umbrella. The independent farmers are saying, this is ridiculous. We should be able, this should be capitalism. We should sell as much as we possibly can, right? So someone along the way thought, yeah, there are these stadium-sized warehouses full of this stuff. It's more expensive than oil. It's like at $3,000 or $4,000 a barrel, and it's sitting there unguarded. We should steal it and sell it on the black market. Again, very much a Mickey, like, I got it. You know what I mean? Hot dog! We'll be rich! But it's insane that this happened. And they did. They stole these barrels, $18 million worth. And the way that they figured out that they were being robbed, because they would put the barrels back and they would fill them. They filled them with water because they measure and weigh everything. But you know what happened? The water condensed. There was condensation on the top of the, and maple syrup doesn't condense. And the barrels started rusting. And that doesn't happen. And so they realized, oh my God, we've been robbed. But that's brilliant. So anyway, you know, that's the real story.
Wow.
Our show borrows the conceit of the heist, but other than that, it creates fictional characters to serve the purpose of the plot. I play Mike Byrne, a desperate, hot-tempered Bostonian mobster who is relegated to collecting the milk or rent money for his employer in Boston from their little franchises on the northern, you know, the southern edge of where Canada meets the United States. And he's just collecting this money. And he's relegated to this because he's a major mess up. Everything he's ever tried to do to prove himself to his mob superiors to say, hey, I can do this, he's messed up. And so when this heist comes to him, when he realizes that there are millions of dollars worth of maple syrup that can be stolen, he sees an opportunity at redemption. And there's nothing funnier than a desperate guy that wants to be redeemed that really isn't the sharpest tool in the shed.
Right. Wow, that sounds unbelievable. And also you gave me a flashback to high school raiding my friend's parents' liquor cabinet and replacing the vodka with water. So I guess great minds.
Listen, there's a little larceny in everyone, to quote Bing Crosby. Yeah.
Oh, that is so fantastic. So when you are connecting with a character like this, what's that process like for you? Do you have to believe that I really think this is a good idea? Like how deep do you go?
Look, it all has to be grounded in reality. And I do believe that to me, I never viewed this as a comedy at all. I looked at it as this, you know, I looked at it the way that you might look at something like Breaking Bad. This is a guy that doesn't wake up in the morning twisting his mustache saying, I'm extra bad today. I'm going to be really evil. This guy wants to do right. He wants to have a woman in his life. He wants a home. He wants his employers, these guys that are very dangerous, to get off his back. He wants some self-respect.
Yeah.
He wants the things that we all want. It's just the way he goes about getting them is really nefarious. And so it all starts from allowing myself to feel that character's vulnerability. And the first thing about this guy that you should know is he doesn't have any vulnerability when you first meet him. He is this perfectly coiffed, he's just... Oh, he is the man. And that's where he starts. And very slowly, that maple syrup is oozing through that degraded waffle. And you realize he's not the man. All he's hoping for is that he can just get through another day. He's really an insecure mess.
Yeah.
And that makes it a lot of fun to play.
Oh, that's so great. You know, thinking about your incredible role on Silicon Valley, you play this psychotic tech billionaire. And I'm wondering, like, seeing the state of the world we're in now, Chris, do you think maybe you underplayed how crazy these guys are?
You know, I will tell you this. The creators of that show, the brilliant Mike Judge and Alec Berg, did tell me when I first signed on, they said, just so you know, everything that you're doing, we have pulled from our meetings when we go and do our production meetings in Silicon Valley and speak with these various VCs and startup people. It's all from reality. We have had to water down what you're doing because no one would believe it.
Wow.
But the truth is it's so much bigger than what, you know, my character comes in screaming, tres comas, you know what I mean? You know, and yet we see, you know, there are a lot of billionaires out there selling tequila these days. I'm just saying. I think that Mike Judge and Alec Berg and the writers on that show, they were prescient in many ways, man.
Yeah.
That was just such a beautifully written show.
Yeah. Back when it was on, I actually interviewed Kumail Nanjiani for Entrepreneur Magazine, and he was talking about some of those tours, meeting some of those guys and saying, you know, they were showing them this crazy tech that they were inventing, but he was like, that's cool, but that's really scary. Like, why are you making that? And he said, no one ever had an answer for why. They were just like, because we can make it look like anyone is saying anything ever.
Yeah, because we can is not a very, that's not a very responsible answer. You wouldn't want a sort of an omniscient deity answering that.
Yeah.
When you say, hey, God, why? Well, because I can. Oh, hurricanes. I get it. Earthquakes. Right. Okay. As you were. Pompeii. Right. Let's go.
Exactly. Yeah.
Why is Mathnasium one of the world's fastest growing franchises? Because demand for after-school math help is skyrocketing, making it an exceptional financial opportunity with the power to change lives. That's also why Mathnasium is consistently recognized as the number one math-only education franchise. With over 1,100 centers worldwide, Mathnasium is the trusted brand in math education, helping students build confidence and develop a love for math. Protected territories are available. Get your free franchise information kit at mathnasiumfranchise.com. That's mathnasiumfranchise.com.
So I want to, you know, as you said, as we're talking about here, your career is just incredible. And I'm wondering if you can remember back or, you know, to early days, to auditions.
Yep.
You know, I'm going to guess, but I'm not positive, everyone didn't go exactly the way you wanted. No. Did you have any kind of mindset to pick yourself up from when things didn't go well for yourself?
Listen, there was a quote, Tom Cruise's character in Jerry Maguire has a quote that is just, it's so apropos of what this business is, an up at dawn pride swallowing siege. And listen, it also happens to be a really, you know, remarkable, fantastical, incredible playground. But I started out doing commercials when I was 9 years old and I was kind of cute, but then puberty hit. And when I was 12 and a half, my agent dropped me overnight because my cute boy look was gone, and
right.
I kind of looked like this, but as a 12-year-old, it was really weird, you know? And so my first brush with rejection was at, I think I was 12 years old when I didn't get a call. I called my agent and they were like, yeah, no, you're no longer represented by this company. And they didn't even call me. They didn't even say anything. It was just done. It was over. Right.
Oh, my God.
And that really became the template for understanding what I was about to encounter. I mean, when I moved to New York, I was 18, 19 years old, and I started pounding the pavement to work in the theater. It took me forever, and I finally started working on Broadway, and I started building a career, and then I knew I really wanted to get into TV and film. And I had an agent say to me, and I quote, oh, honey, you'll work on stage because people can be far enough away from you to not realize that you're not really that handsome.
Oh.
And he said, putting you on screen, you're what we call TV ugly.
Oh my God.
Yeah, absolutely. You're what we call TV ugly. And he said, I'm sorry to break this to you, but you'll never work on screen. Now listen, this was an agent I respected. He was a nice guy. He got me,
Sounds lovely.
I think he was actually, he was trying to do two things. Number one, he wanted me to stay there to keep earning him a commission in the theater. But number two, okay. I genuinely think that he thought that I was going to have my heart broken. And I'll tell you, I moved out to LA with my wife. When we met in New York, she was 22. I was 25. We moved out to LA and I looked like I was 40. And they would say, your dad has to wait in the car at her auditions when I would drive her to her auditions.
Yeah.
And she started working instantly. In the first 2 weeks, she started booking jobs left, right, and center. She's on the Lincoln Lawyer now. Becky's.
Oh yeah.
More talented, far more smart, far more successful than I could ever be. And I've married up to the nth degree. I'm the luckiest man alive. But that
congratulations.
Been congratulations. Yeah, thank you. No, but it took me 2 years to even have an agent return a phone call. And what they would say to me is, look, you're 26, but you look like you're 46. And that was at the time when the OC was the big show and everyone wanted the strapping blonde, blue-eyed American, you know, Abercrombie and Fitch models. And I looked like Jack Lemmon, you know what I mean? Like it, and I love Jack Lemmon. I think he's perfectly handsome, but that's not what they wanted at the CW.
Yeah. Right.
So every audition was that for me. I had to carry on going over. I remember once getting feedback from an agent when I called to find out, is it going further? And she said the feedback was, ugh. That was the feedback. Ugh.
Oh my God.
So first of all, fuck you, agent, for telling me that, but also a little fuck me for asking. But most of all, fuck that executive for saying that. Fuck you. But then it comes full circle to thank you, because all of the, I'm like the Rocky Balboa of this business. The hits just sort of made me keep coming back for more. I don't know why. I'm a glutton. I knew that this is what I want. It doesn't get any easier. There's no hierarchical shift. It's like you do a movie that George Clooney directs. You don't then do a movie that, you know, Spielberg directs. No, you go back to auditioning for, you know, maybe a role on something here or something that.
Right.
It's just, you just keep going. But Clooney did say something to me that was really meaningful on that set. I talked to him. I was like, God, how did you deal with auditioning? Because, you know, I knew he did a ton of pilots before he finally broke through.
Yeah.
And he said, he goes, look, man, auditions are like going to a casino and playing with house money.
Huh.
You can't lose. If you don't get it, doesn't matter. You got a chance to act. You got a chance to try something. If you do get it, you just got something for nothing.
Yeah.
And I love that. I would love to get to a point where I don't have to audition for everything. There are projects that come to me, but for the most part, the ones that I really want, I go for it, man. And I would say 98% of them, I don't get even close to, but those 2% that I do get, they're life changing.
Oh, that's awesome. And, you know, whether it's someone who wants to be an actor or a writer, or I have a business and I'm trying to sell my products, or I'm trying to pitch investors, you know, get a lot of no's out there. So
It's only no until you do it so much that by some stretch of the physics of, you know, auditory perception, no yes. Like there are no yeses. It's only no. And you have to, in some kind of, you know, otherworldly way, make the no a yes. Even Don Quixote, like, I'm not hearing no anymore. I am galloping toward the yes. That's the only answer. There's no other way to do it.
That's great. Oh, man. I love that. I love that. Ugh. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So as much as you are, you know, your own product, I guess, but you are in movies and TV shows with other people, and there's a director and there's a count. So it's a very collaborative thing that you are a part of.
Yep.
What have you learned about what makes a good collaboration? I'm sure in your field, people have a lot of different techniques, how they get ready for the scene or how they are in the scene. How do you kind of vibe with people who have totally different processes?
It's a great question. So television and film are, I would say that probably the most collaborative field that there is. And you know, I've learned it in my career the hard way. Because, you know, early in my career and even mid into my career, the only opportunities that were really available to me were the scraps that would fall from the tables of the guys that had already progressed far past where I was. So I didn't have access to scripts that were written, you know, by brilliant screenwriters, directed by award-winning directors and produced by these wonderful, you know, producers. I had access to much lesser material. And then I would think to myself, well, it doesn't matter. It's lesser material, but I'm a great actor. I'm going to get in there and I'm going to do it. And I get the job and I do my best. And I'm, you know, it's blood, sweat, and tears. And it's crickets. Because the collaborative aspect of that is that the material still wasn't great. And the director wasn't great. And it wasn't produced well. And it doesn't matter if I'm giving you Laurence Olivier, if it's done in an Olive Garden commercial. Sorry, guys. You know, that is what it is. You know what I mean? Yeah. So there was a real understanding for me early on that, yeah, I can give it my all, but if I'm not supported by my fellow actors, by my director, by the writer, by the cinematographer, by the editor, that's huge. You can give it all.
Yeah.
And if it ends up on the cutting room floor, if they decide that you're not number one, two, or three on the call sheet, and they would rather show this in the edit, and then, you know what I mean? What are you going to do? There's nothing you can do. So, you know, that's... So then you have to look for the script. You know, you start building in your career and it's like, okay, I have access to that script. I know a bunch of other guys are going to be auditioning for that, but none of them is as hungry as me and none of them is going to put into it. And then you get it and you're like, oh, I got the script. And then you meet the director and you're like, oh, they're unhinged. Like they're not prepared. They don't have a shot list. They're not ready for this. And then it's like, oh, the script is great, but, and then you release the thing and it's like, that's not great because the director just wasn't great. Or you get the script and you realize the director's great and you're like, oh my God, this is happening. It's finally happening. I'm working with a great actor. This director knows what they're doing. I got a great script. But the studio doesn't put any money behind it and they don't advertise it. And so, you know what I mean? It's all of these elements that if they don't, that's where alchemy, you know, really comes into play. That's where this is the last business that is based on magic. It really is. It's an alchemical formula. It is taking lead, and the lead is screenwriter, director, producer, cinematographer, actors, and then it's hoping that the gods shine down on it and turn it into gold, because we've all seen it. We see these wonderful directors, these incredible screenwriters and actors produce stuff that we look at and go, wow, this is terrible.
Yeah.
And they're not terrible. It's just that the collaboration didn't work. And that brings me to the sticky. I couldn't have budgeted for how Margot Martindale, Guillaume Sir, and I would have chemistry on screen.
Yeah.
But it was instant. And when people watch the show, you know, whether it's their tempo or not, you can't deny our chemistry. We're like one person. You know what I mean? I'm the brawn, he's the heart, and she's the brains. It's really great.
Oh, that's so, you know, you could have taken that sentence in a different direction. It brings me to the sticky. It was horrible.
Right, it's true. And by the way, the difference of it going in one direction or the other was complete luck. I lucked into the fact that Margot Martindale happens to be, you know, a super gifted, super professional master at her craft. We lucked into the fact that Guillaume Cyr, despite the fact that this is his first English speaking role, has a prolific French career. And has, you know, and is an incredibly gifted professional actor, and not for nothing, but they lucked into the fact that I've been doing this as long as I have, and I care about this almost as much as I care about my children. You know what I mean? It really is. It's everything to me. So, yeah.
Do your kids' friends insist on Mickey Mouse voices a lot, or do you insist on Mickey Mouse voices?
You know, it's funny, man. Every so often, I'll walk by the living room, and my 5-year-old is watching either Mickey Mouse or something else that I've done, or I can hear my son upstairs watching Invincible or Blood of Zeus or something. And it's neat. Listen, cartoons were such a huge part of my childhood. Saturday morning cartoons, that was everything, man. I remember watching Mr. T. I remember watching Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, Looney Tunes. I mean, it's huge. And when I hear kids being entertained by something that I'm voicing, I don't know. That's about as good as it gets, man. I absolutely love
it. I just discovered this little gem.
So good. So good.
I just held up an Invincible thing for anyone who's not watching.
It's terrific. It's really, really great. And I play Donald Ferguson on the show. He's sort of very, very straight-laced character who ends up going through a pretty amazing evolution. But they also allow me to try my hand at some of my character voices. When I was growing up in the 80s, there was an actor, I forget his name, but he played Starscream in the Transformers cartoon, and he played Cobra Commander in the G.I. Joe cartoon.
Yeah.
And his voice, I loved his voice. It was the most unique voice. But he kind of sounded like this, Destro, this way. So I used that voice for Doc Seismic in Invincible. You'll never catch me.
Oh my God. That's so great. Oh my God. That is so great. Oh, wow. You just sent, I'm having all kinds of time traveling trip here. Yeah. Yep. Holy cow.
Yeah. It's the only way to make that no turn into a yes. I'm telling
you.
You gotta just bend it a little bit.
Oh my God, that's so great. I wanted to ask you about collaborations because also, so one of your collaborators made a lot of news recently by discussing his quickie bathroom habit on the set. The Rock talked about peeing into an empty water bottle to save time. A lot of hubbub about that.
Interesting.
I kind of related because I've been stuck at 3-hour Little League games where there was no woods.
I'm going to tell you this right now. I think I have the bladder of an 8-year-old child. When I read that, I sympathized with the guy. I was like, and listen, he's not, you know, peeing on the sidewalk. He's putting it into a vessel.
Exactly. Okay?
Yes. And he's not Howard Hughes-ing it. You know what I mean? He's not putting it up on a shelf and labeling it, you know, Happy Tuesday or whatever. You know, he's not drinking it like, you know, about 10 years ago, they were telling us we should do. No. I get it. And I have to say, for the record, Dwayne Johnson is a prince, man. I've done two movies with him. Oh, that guy is just a lovable, lovable guy. You can say what you want, but the guy just exudes a charisma and a warmth, and he's such a, for as much bravado as he has and as much confidence as he has, he's incredibly humble. He's a really good guy to everyone around him. People on the cruise just love him. Oh, he's terrific. I love Dwayne Johnson.
Man, with your voices, I'm just thinking, I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah.
But we got to get you in the WWE ring, you know, tag teaming with The Rock, maybe.
Amazing. That sounds fantastic, actually. I'm in. But I'd have to have some major clause in my contract that they can't touch my face. Because you don't want to mess with TV ugly. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, man. Well, this has been such a treat talking to you. I mean, you're kind of a low energy guy, but whatever, we got through it. We pushed through it.
You can edit it and actually put some of the stuff in post.
Yeah, exactly. Go. I'm wondering if maybe in the voice of Cobra Commander or whatever voice of your choosing, you could give everyone, you know, the people who are striving to do something. It's not easy to do whatever we're trying to do, but maybe give them a little pep talk. That tomorrow morning they're going to wake up and they're going to put their first foot forward to achieving their dream.
I mean, the best person to do that is this guy. And he would say, well, hot dog, I believe in you and you should believe in you. Tomorrow is the first day of the rest of your life. Go get it.
Thank you, Mickey. Thank you, Chris Diamantopoulos. Always awesome talking to you. And The Sticky is on Amazon Prime right now and on other streaming services. A million other things this guy has been in, and they're all great. So I encourage you to check it all out. Chris, thanks so much for joining us here once again.
Thanks for having me. This was a blast. Thanks.
That's our show. Thanks again to Chris Diamantopoulos. Please subscribe to How Success Happens. Leave us a comment, a star, 2 stars, 5 stars. I'm not telling you how many stars, but any stars would be great. And be sure to check out this episode and past episodes on Entrepreneur Media's YouTube channel, where you can finally find out if I'm as handsome as I sound.
Why is Mathnasium one of the world's fastest growing franchises? Because demand for after-school math help is skyrocketing, making it an exceptional financial opportunity with the power to change lives. That's also why Mathnasium is consistently recognized as the number one math-only education franchise. With over 1,100 centers worldwide, Mathnasium is the trusted brand in math education, helping students build confidence and develop a love for math. Protected territories are available. Get your free franchise information kit at mathnasiumfranchise.com. That's mathnasiumfranchise.com.